Welcome to Crisis Management. I'm Alicia Sikorska. On today's episode, the federal election has come to a close, and it's out with the old and in with the same old. We'll dig into what the top priorities should be for this newly elected minority liberal government. And now that the election is over, business groups are urging the new government to get going on the pandemic recovery. We'll take a look at what this means for the status of some of the COVID-19 recovery programs. And we'll also dig into the latest on the She session. Now, to get through all this, I am joined by Sean Spear. Sean is a fellow in residence at the Public Policy Forum, and he served as senior economic advisor for former Prime Minister Stephen Harper. And Sean is here to help us dig through the policy issues brought forward by COVID-19. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Alicia.
So let's start things off with the election. After 36 days of campaigning, the 44th election has come to a close with Justin Trudeau's Liberals edging out Erin O'Toole's Conservatives. Now, while there are a few ridings that are still too close to call, it is not going to have an effect on the general overall results, which currently see the Liberals with 158 seats, the Conservatives with 119, the Bloc with 34, and the NDP with 25. Now, throughout the campaign, Trudeau faced a lot of criticism over his decision to call this election in the midst of a pandemic. Let's listen to a part of his victory speech that he gave on Monday night.
I hear you when you say that you just want to get back to the things you love, not worry about this pandemic or about an election, that you just want to know that your members of Parliament of all stripes will have your back through this crisis and beyond. The moment we face demands real, important change. And you have given this Parliament and this government clear direction.
So, Sean, this election results, we're essentially back to where we started, as I mentioned off the top of the show. But what do you think the immediate priority needs to be for this new Trudeau government?
Well, that's a fascinating question. It was maybe just worth starting, how this campaign played out. You'll recall, Alicia, that we had an episode soon after the election kicked off that Mr. Trudeau described as one of the most important in our country's history. And it was supposed to be a kind of competition of ideas with respect to post-pandemic recovery. The problem, of course, is the virus won't give up. It not only has persisted, we are now living in, by all accounts, a fourth wave. And so I think Mr. Trudeau's initial preference was for this campaign to, represent a kind of pivot point in our country's ongoing challenges with the pandemic. But instead, we ended up with a campaign that was primarily focused on the pandemic, issues around vaccine mandates, vaccine passports, and so on. So I think in the end, we have a composition of parliament that's essentially unchanged from where it was in the last parliament. And the issue that will dominate discussion is the same that it was in the last parliament, and that is the country's ongoing challenges with the pandemic. And in that sense, I think the primary question facing the incoming government is what, if any, extensions need to be granted to the expiring relief programs, given that there's a reasonable prospect that we're not just going to see a postponement of the easing of public health restrictions. We're seeing in some parts of the country, including Alberta, of course, the reintroduction of public health restrictions. So I guess that's a long way of saying this campaign wasn't about a post-pandemic recovery. It's very much about dealing with the immediacy of the pandemic, and I suspect that will be the top issue facing this newly configured but mostly unchanged federal parliament.
I think it's quite remarkable how unchanged it really is, and that overall number, like the voters clearly spoke and didn't want that things to change too much, clearly. But on that, on tackling the pandemic, I mean, in terms of, given that we are in the midst of the fourth wave, what are some of the immediate priorities that the government needs to take on as soon as possible?
Well, the challenge here, of course, is federalism. So most of the kind of on the ground decisions about vaccine passports or about public health restrictions with respect to commercial activity or social activity reside at the provincial and local level. Ottawa's, I think, primary function with respect to the pandemic at this stage, having ultimately delivered on vaccine supply, is really around those emergency supports that have sustained households and sustained businesses over the course of the pandemic. I think there was a view that those could be wound down given the progress we were making on vaccinations and a sense that we really were at a point where we could look beyond the pandemic. I think as soon as the cabinet is reappointed, I think one of the first choices it'll have to make is, do those programs need to be extended? Given the fact that the pandemic is still very much with us, and people are anticipating, as you know, Alicia, that we may require another wave of provincial restrictions. You know, whether it's childcare or education or even some businesses. So I do think at this point the primary federal role is around these emergency relief programs and whether they need to continue for the foreseeable future.
Do you think these results at all change the government's ability to get this stuff done in a minority parliament, given that now the election is out of the way and clearly no party is going to want to head back to the polls in the immediate future?
Maybe on the margins, although, you know, notwithstanding Mr. Trudeau's claims, you know, the idea that the last parliament represented a major obstacle to progress on these programs and other issues, I think is a bit weak. I take your point, Alicia, that one of the outcomes of the election results is, I think, a degree of humility for all of the parties. You know, I think one can plausibly argue none of them were really winners in the end result. And so I suspect you will see less focus on the part of the parties about the next election and more about working together in that minority context. In this vein, I think, you know, one idea I'd put on the table for viewers is one of the outcomes of the election campaign is I do think we'll see progress on the remaining provinces with regards to these childcare agreements. Viewers will know that prior to the election, the Liberals had signed, or the federal government, that is, had signed agreements with several of the provinces. There were some holdouts who I think were waiting to see the outcome of the election campaign. Now that we have that outcome, I think you'll see Ontario and Alberta fall into line and sign these agreements. And so, you know, if you're a supporter of a national child care system, I think it's reasonable to think that it is now with us. And I would bet that in the next election campaign, the Conservatives in particular that have been opposed to these to a national child care system essentially accept them as sort of part of the government policy, just as it did, for instance, on marijuana legalization, which was a big issue in 2015, and 6 years later is essentially kind of accepted conventional policy. So that may be one way in which the election outcome changes things.
Yeah, once you introduce those kind of benefits or policies, it's really hard to scale them back once they're already out there. But Sean, let's dig into some of the reaction that we are seeing from the business community in response to this minority government. You've touched on a bit of this already, but groups like the CFIB, the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, and Canada Business Council have all urged the government to immediately start working with other parties and focus on growing the economy. Here's what Perrin Beatty, from the CEO of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, had to say following the election. The clear message from last night's election is that our politicians need to get back to work on the issues that matter. With an election that lacked a meaningful debate on the economy, it is critical for Parliament and the government to resume the business of governing the country. Canadians want less politics and more leadership from their elected officials. Now, part of what Beatty says the government does need to focus on is what you were mentioning before, extending the wage and rent subsidy programs to ensure that there is support for the sectors that have been hit hardest by COVID-19. That's something that the CFIB is also pushing for, particularly in the wake of vaccine passports that have been introduced across the country. So let's dig into the extension of those programs. I mean, what do you make of that demand? And is this something that the government needs to look at right now?
I think the short answer is yes. And in fact, I would guess that we will see their renewal in the coming days. I think some of them are expiring, you know, as we speak, or have just recently expired. But given the facts on the ground, given, you know, the number of cases that we're seeing in some provinces and the prospect of a renewed call for public health restrictions, as we've recently seen in Alberta, I do think that the federal government will renew at least some of these programs. And I suspect it will be, you know, pushed there in part based on the facts on the ground, but also by the opposition parties, particularly the New Democrats, who will have, you know, considerable influence in this new minority parliament.
Is there a way, because these programs have been going on for, it'll be close to 2 years soon, should they at this point be more focused or have that end in sight? Or is there just so much uncertainty that we still need that flexibility for these programs?
It's a great question, Alicia. I'm not sure the government is in a position to announce a concrete end date. You know, in some ways, if you would have done that in the past, you would have been betting wrong, you know, given the unpredictability of the virus. But on your first point about making it more targeted, I do think there's something there. I mean, let's recognize that while employment is still lower than it was prior to the pandemic, the gap between pre-pandemic employment rate and current employment rate has significantly narrowed in recent months. And so the primary employment issues are concentrated in a small number of sectors that are kind of disproportionately affected by some of these different restrictions and a kind of general uncertainty that looms over the Canadian economy. So that's a long way of saying I think initially it made sense for general emergency relief programs. I think as we continue through the pandemic, there's a stronger case for making them more targeted, more context specific, given that for most people, the kind of worst of the pandemic induced recession is now over.
That is what you are seeing the Chamber of Commerce call for. It's sector specific, you know, extensions for these wage subsidy and rent subsidy programs. Although I think the CFIB is looking at it from a more broader sense. I know that you have looked at the wage subsidy and see that there are ways to experiment with that in order to help other workers out. Can you explain what you mean by that or what kind of potential this program has in the future past this pandemic?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that, Alicia. So viewers will know that the wage subsidy over the past 2 months has really been about keeping workers on staff during the recession, as opposed to laying them off and weakening their attachment to a particular employer or to work more generally. So wage subsidies have been deployed in the context of the pandemic with this very specific goal in mind. I actually think the principle of wage subsidies may have a kind of more general usefulness out beyond the pandemic. There are a lot of workers in our economy, Alicia, who've been unemployed for long periods of time. And there's a lot of evidence that long-term unemployment makes it more challenging for people to get reattached to the workforce. And then there are other population groups who have weak labor force attachment. I'm thinking, for instance, Indigenous peoples, or recent immigrants. So I do think that outside of the pandemic, there may be a case for using wage subsidies as a means of helping those people with weak labor force attachment get over the hump, in effect, incentivize or subsidize employers to hire these people to strengthen, to rebuild their workforce attachment. These would not be wage subsidies that would continue on an ongoing basis, but just to help kind of get those people across the line back to work, back into employment, rebuild that experience, those gaps in their resume. I'm actually a kind of proponent of wage subsidies more generally, not in the kind of broad-based way that we've seen over the past couple of years, but in a more targeted way, focused particularly on those with weak labor force attachment.
It's really interesting and brings us to our next issue, which is that ongoing labor shortage that we are seeing in Canada and the potential solutions to it. Many businesses are still struggling to find workers. And while economies have reopened more substantially, employment numbers have yet to recover. As you mentioned, the gap has narrowed, but there is still a gap from pre-pandemic levels, including for women in the workforce who were hit particularly hard in this pandemic. Economist Armin Yelnazian wrote in the Toronto Star that the female unemployment rate has yet to recover in 2021. Canada-wide employment for women is at 56.7%, which is a level that we last saw in 2002. And regionally, the recovery differs. In Quebec and BC, it's back to 2016 levels. But here in Ontario, where I am, if we're still stuck in 1999 in terms of the employment for women. Sean, this seems to be the biggest issue that is facing businesses these days, is getting people on staff. And so what kind of policy solutions does this new government need to look at to help these businesses out and get people back to work?
It's a great question. And something we've talked a bit about on this program before, the idea that the pandemic-induced spike in unemployment actually obscured the bigger long-term labor market challenge, which is we're going to have more jobs than we are workers. And that's just merely a function of arithmetic. We have an aging population, and we have fewer workers replacing those who are aging out of the workforce. And this is creating this both general sense of labor shortages across the economy, but then very concentrated labor shortages in particular sectors or particular regions. And Armin, in particular, I think, has done an important kind of public service drawing attention to this issue at a time when most other commentators have focused on the immediacy of the unemployment challenges. So then the question, of course, is what can we do to address labor shortages going forward? You know, there's oftentimes a focus on immigration policy, and I don't diminish that. I think obviously immigration is going to be part of the solution. But I think the bigger issue, Alicia, is business investment. Of course, capital and labor are substitutes. And, you know, for a long time, Canadian employers, Canadian businesses have relied on labor inputs. But in a world of labor shortages, I think there'll be more pressure to invest in capital that can, in effect, make their companies more productive and less dependent on labor. And we continue to have a fairly significant business investment problem in this country that really, you know, it's been exacerbated by the pandemic, but it would be wrong to think that it's merely a function of the pandemic. So I think if I was to prioritize one set of policies to deal with labor shortages, it would be incentives around encouraging business investment, whether that's faster depreciation rates, whether that's investment tax credits, other means of trying to pull capital into the market, make companies more productive and less dependent on labor going forward.
Interesting. So you see that business investment just as a way to help make companies more efficient? Is that kind of the solution here?
Exactly. For a long time, I think businesses have, you know, think about the extraordinary thing is we're about to enter just a fundamental sea change in the world of Canadian labor markets. Because of the baby boom, the story of Canadian labor markets for the better part of 30 or 40 years has been surplus labor. We've been focused on unemployment as a country. But going forward, that problem is going to completely flip. And the question won't be, do we have too much labor? It's, do we have insufficient labor? And because of these labor surpluses that we've had around the country for a long time, businesses have been able to rely on labor inputs as opposed to thinking more strategically about how investments in technology and other productivity enhancing equipment can actually substitute for workers for labor. That I think will become increasingly important going forward. And there may be indeed a role for government to try to catalyze that investment. One of the upsides of that, Alicia, is it will enable the scarce labor that we have to go to the most productive parts of the economy where it can really make a difference. We have a lot of human capital right now filling roles, filling positions that could be better, you know, better served with technology, and those people could then fill areas where labor is important, including, for instance, the care economy, where it's much harder to replace people with technology. And yet we know that we're going to have massive shortages. We already are having massive shortages in long-term care, hospitals, childcare, and so on. So, you know, I think in a big picture way, investments in technology is going to be a key part of how we address these labor shortages in Canada.
Yeah. So what happens in those industries and sectors that you mentioned, including the service one, which was hit so hard in the pandemic, and where we saw a significant chunk of the women who are unemployed came from that? I mean, what happens in those industries? How do you bring that workforce back?
Well, I mean, in the immediacy of the pandemic, a big part of it is giving people, consumers, confidence that they can be in restaurants or they can be in retail stores, and that the risk to their health and the health of their family is limited. And, you know, we've talked a lot on this program about how vaccine passports are part of that. They're a means of giving people confidence about the safety for them and their families. But then more fundamentally, you know, I think that one of the big questions coming out of the pandemic, Alicia, is how many people over the past, you know, 20 months or so have actually invested in their human capital so that they're not going back to the jobs that they left prior to the pandemic. They're going to higher value occupations elsewhere, which is sort of what I'm talking about. The idea that, you know, in a world of labor scarcity, we want people in the most productive positions available to them. So I think it will put real pressure on food, hospitality, other service-based industries where the labor just isn't going to come back, and they're going to have to think about how to make their operations more efficient and productive through these types of investments, where in the past they've been able to rely on workers to sustain their operations.
I definitely think anecdotally you've heard of a lot of people who have left the sector entirely because in the pandemic, in that time when everything was closed, that they've, you know, learned new skills, found other jobs, moved away. So it'll be interesting to see, as you said, how those sectors recover. Speaking of a bit of a stalled recovery with the Delta variant and fourth wave of COVID-19, still ongoing. Many companies have held off return to work plans and still have their employees working from home. And we're seeing this reflected in office vacancy rates. According to the CBRE group, the office vacancy rate in Canada hit 15.7% in the third quarter of the year. That's the highest level since 1994. Now, vacancy rates vary by city. Vancouver's is the lowest at 7.4%. Toronto is at 13.7%, and Calgary is at 30%. But Sean, with people still working from home, do you think that what impact is this going to have, the fact that vacancy rates are up, going forward on the future of the office?
Yeah, I think this is one of the most fascinating questions coming out of the pandemic. I spoke yesterday to about 75 rural mayors, councillors, and reeves across the country about this question of the future of remote work and the end possibly of the urban downtown, where you have, you know, these massive office towers that people commute to every day, and is a source of so much economic activity in our country. I do think the longer that the remote work experiment continues, the greater likelihood, Alicia, that we don't revert back to pre-pandemic practices, and in fact that the remote work phenomenon and the flee from cities phenomenon becomes more durable, that businesses have now invested in kind of building up the capacity to enable a remote work option, that employees have grown accustomed to the flexibility that it grants, that people in downtown Toronto have purchased homes in Cobourg and other surrounding cities and communities. So I must admit, this is one subject where my thinking has evolved over the course of the campaign, over the course of the pandemic, rather. If you would have asked me, you know, 6 months ago, were we going to revert back to, you know, a kind of urban-driven economy where people lived and worked in big cities, I would have said yes. But the longer this persists, the more I think there is a real possibility that these vacancies persist as we see companies kind of fundamentally change the way in which they organize their employees and the ways in which people work.
It's going to be interesting to watch, particularly the trickle-down effects that that does have. I cover a lot of food service industry companies, including Tim Hortons, and they are having where they're not recovering their business is in, they call it the super urban locations. So right downtown where they usually expect foot traffic from people that are working in offices, and that has just completely disappeared. And so there's lots of businesses like that that are going to be affected by and have been affected already by all of this. But Sean, before we wrap up the show, I do want to talk about one other subject that we discuss a lot on the show, and that's vaccine mandates. But I want to talk about a company that has implemented quite, I think it's fair to say, an aggressive vaccine mandate that appears to have worked. United Airlines in the US says more than 97% of its employees are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. And that comes less than a week before a deadline the airline set for people to get vaccinated or else face termination. Now, there has been a lawsuit filed against United by 6 employees over discrimination as a result of this mandate, but the company has said it believes the complaint is, quote, without merit. The company also says that resignations in response to this mandate have been in the single digits. Now, United has 67,000 employees in the U.S., so this is a significant number that 97% are fully vaccinated. Sean, what do you think companies can learn from United's approach, which has been much more aggressive than what other businesses have opted to take?
Yeah, I think we're going to see more of this. I don't know American jurisprudence well enough to kind of comment on the legality of the mandate in the lawsuit that you mentioned. But my understanding is in Canada, these types of employer mandates, if they're broad, if that is to say they affect their entire workforce, we would hold up to legal action. And so, yeah, I think this is already we're seeing Canadian companies adopt similar policies. I think we'll see more of it, not less. Part of it is about protecting the kind of health and safety of their workers and the potential liabilities associated with that. But I think increasingly this is also about public relations, Alicia. I think, you know, the vaccinated public is growing increasingly tired of the others, non-vaccinated Canadians, not moving ahead and ultimately getting the vaccination. And so I think companies are doing this both for kind of internal financial reasons, but also I think because this is the subject of growing demand, I think, on the part of the general population. So, yeah, I think interesting sign out of United, and I think I would bet we'll see more of this to come in the coming days and weeks.
Yeah, do you see this as just something that makes sense for businesses and for companies when it comes to that their financials and just operations in general, that this is just something that makes sense for them to get through this pandemic?
Yes, I think the short answer is yes. I now get to marry my two biggest interests, policy and hockey. And NHL training camps are resuming this week. And we're seeing the same outcomes there, Alicia. Teams are announcing, you know, that maybe one player or one team official has chosen not to be vaccinated. And as a result, is going to forego potential employment or income because they won't be able to travel with the team. So these type of employer mandates are clearly working. And for that reason, I think I think they will become the norm, especially because, as we've discussed on previous episodes, there may be constitutional limits on the ability of governments to impose such mandates. So having employers do it, I think, achieves essentially the same outcome and is more likely to be upheld in the face of potential legal challenge.
Okay, Sean, well, that's all the time that we have for today. Thank you so much again for the fascinating discussion.
Thanks as always, Alicia.
Now, if you want to rewatch this episode or get the latest news about the coronavirus pandemic, please visit Yahoo Finance Canada's website. And if you have any questions for Sean or feedback about the show, please feel free to email me. I'm at Alicia at yahoofinance.com. Thanks for tuning in.